What if this isn't a climate crisis, but the greatest opportunity humanity has had in a long time? Lean Into Clean will explore and discuss with highly esteemed guests on what could be the new spirals for society, sustainability, spirituality, and social harmony. Perhaps we've all lost our way. Lean Into Clean will showcase how we might remember, refocus and restore the natural ways so we can again live in balance and harmony with life on Earth and all its inhabitants. Welcome back to Lean Into Clean. I hope you're all having a fabulous sunny Monday. I'm Jarvis Smith. This is UK Health Radio. My guest today has been described by The Independent as, by popular consent, the most effective of Britain's eco-warriors. And by the ENDS report, as one of the top 10 environmental figures of the last 30 years. He spent more than 40 years in the defence of nature. He started out as an ornithologist working to save the world's most endangered parrots, spent 18 years at Friends of the Earth, where he led the big ass campaign that gave us the Climate Change Act, no small feat, and served as environmental advisor to the then Prince of Wales, now King Charles III, co-authoring Harmony with him. He has been chair of Natural England since 2019 and is now the longest serving chair in the organisation's history. He also chairs the rainforest charity Cool Earth, is a fellow at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, and has written some of the most environmental books of our, the most important environmental books of our time, including What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? Rainforest, and his latest, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. Dr. Tony Juniper, a warm welcome to you, my friend.
Thank you, Jarvis. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. When you listen back to everything that you've done, is there anything that's missing there? Any complaints or regrets?
No, that's pretty good, Jarvis. It's been busy, actually, when you put it like that. It does feel like there's been quite a lot packed into the last 40 plus years of activity, and it all comes from childhood obsession with the natural world, really. Fish, birds, insects, reptiles, fossils, you name it. I had various phases as a youngster whereby, you know, I became, you know, super obsessed with particular groups of animals and plants. And, you know, when you start doing that, you begin to understand what's happening to them. And that then inevitably, in my case, led to, you know, a lifetime's work to try and save the natural world, which continues, fortunately, in the sense of still being able to do it.
Yeah, that is fabulous. It's funny, you've actually beat me to my first question, because I was looking at your career. I mean, we've obviously got a history, and I'll talk about that later in the show. I've known you for a long time now. Actually, as long as my sustainability and environmental career, you've been very much on my shoulder for all that time. You were particularly attracted to the prevention of the extinction of critically endangered parrots. That must have been something that was just an extraordinary exclusive thing to do, or unique thing to do for a start, particularly living in England. I mean, there can't have been many parrots around at that time.
no, exactly. Well, we do have those ringneck parakeets living in London, but they weren't on our list of endangered species, as you can imagine. So this work, Jarvis, that was with what used to be called the International Council for Bird Preservation, but which is now a global network of bird organisations called BirdLife International. And my job there back in the late 1980s was to try and stop the extinction of some of the rarest parrots on Earth. And at the time, and I think probably still the case now, it was regarded as the most endangered bird family on Earth. There's about 350 species of parrots, mostly scattered across the tropics, living in the tropical rainforests and other forest ecosystems. And about 100 of them were regarded as at some risk of extinction. And some of them were really at the very edge of being lost for good. And so the work was about trying to avoid that. And a lot of it was research and publishing various assessments and trying to bring people together, trying to set up protected areas in key places, and some field work as well. And amongst all of the things that I did over that period, probably the outstanding experience that will always remain with me was the search for a parrot called the Spix's macaw.
Yes.
It's a very, very rare blue parrot living in the northeast of Brazil. And at the time, late 1980s, possibly extinct in the wild. And so an expedition was staged to go and look for it in this very dry, remote part of northeastern Brazil. And I went into the field with four Brazilian scientists, and we spent several months searching high and low across a very remote part of interior Brazil. And yeah, we found it, or we found one. We found the last remaining bird living on Earth. And
Wow.
that actually stimulated a captive breeding program because there were 13 of them in captivity at the time.
Ah,
We
yeah.
found the last one. We were pretty sure that, this thing now is doomed to extinction unless we can use these few birds in captivity to start a breeding program. And, looking back now, we're 36 years, 30, yeah, 36 years since that expedition. And the bird has been reintroduced back to the wild from the captive breeding program. And so, that, yeah, a tragic example in the sense of going down to, functional extinction, but then a wonderful example of how recovery can be nurtured, even in such dire circumstances. And that story, of course, finished up being turned into the film Rio.
Yes, the big Disney film, wasn't
Yeah,
it?
big 20th Century Fox, big 20th Century Fox film.
Right, yeah.
I was moved to complain. They had used my book that I wrote subsequent to that work,
Wow.
but they didn't credit the book anywhere or ask me about it. So I was a bit annoyed by that. But the power of the story, obviously, the writers of that film had spotted and turned into, it's a good film. But I'd say it was a good book too, so it's not surprising.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, Tony. And I was reminded of that as you were telling me the story. But often the work that you do and the work that we do, because you've absolutely influenced my career, we are, I think, in marketing terms, we're described as early adopters, as people that get movements happening. And often that flap of a butterfly wing that we begin, can end up as a hurricane on the other side of the world. And it's very much that. And I'm guessing that you probably have found a lot of that in your career because you've stood for something that most people didn't even know or weren't aware of. And how many of those examples can you recall? Because I bet there's loads.
Yeah, there are quite a few, and some of them go back to conversations over a cup of coffee, and then they turn into something a little bit more serious, and then turn into an initiative, and then finish up being something that is truly impactful. And I guess the campaign for the Climate Change Act would be one of those, where at Friends of the Earth back in the early 2000s, I'd just been appointed as director. And it was very evident that the world was changing around then. We'd been working for years on a whole range of different subjects, water pollution, protection of wildlife in England, sustainable agriculture, transport policy, a whole raft of different things, recycling. And it became apparent around 2003 that the discussion was changing. Climate change was becoming something more prominent on the agenda. We'd known about it for years, but it was very, very hard to get any kind of popular mainstream traction on it. And then we thought, actually, things are now beginning to shift and people are beginning to understand this.
Yeah.
And so we said to ourselves, what can we do to make a difference on this? And we tossed around lots of different ideas. And then one of our people, Bryony Worthington, she had the brilliant idea that we should campaign for a Climate Change Act, which would set out over a period of decades, pollution budgets, which would gradually tighten between then and 2050 to get us down to what was then deemed to be the level that would be safe for the global climate if you took Britain's share of that of that pie of pollution, if you put it like that. And
Yeah.
that was then the birth of the idea, which then turned into the big ask campaign, which we fully prioritized at Friends of the Earth. We slimmed down our other campaigns, put a lot of effort behind that, and in 2008 had the breakthrough with the adoption by Parliament, Royal Assent of the Climate Change Act 2008, which was a world first, and which then subsequently had impacts on the Paris Climate Agreement in setting the scene for domestically determined action, and led to dozens of other countries adopting similar measures. And so, that it was a good idea by a colleague. We got behind it, we pulled it together and turned it into a really fantastic campaign, which was in some large part not only down to the wisdom of the idea, but also a fantastic piece of communications work by a couple of communications folks who just joined Friends of the Earth at the time, Nicola and Bastian, helped us design the Big Ask campaign. And so, it was my privilege to lead all of that as director, and to get what was, certainly one of the high points for the Green movement in Britain over decades.
And that act is still very much in place
Oh,
today.
yes, it is. Yeah. Well, we're in a different place now in the sense of the political consensus which enabled it has broken down somewhat. And we have the Conservative Party and the Reform Party, both now with a policy to repeal the Climate Change Act. And that would, of course, in the eyes of those who are paying attention to the science, of course, be a retrograde step. And, I can't really comment on politics in my current role, naturally, so won't do. It'll be interesting to see what the voters think of that.
I agree. I agree. I mean, certainly from my side, you can definitely see there is a movement towards the Green Party, and there's more people coming into the space, and I think politics is definitely changing. But I know you can't comment on it, so we won't talk about it. But let's go from, I guess, what you were then was a serious campaigner, kind of campaigning on the outside, and now you're leading a government agency, literally from within. So some would see that as crossing the line, Tony. But how do you think about the difference between pushing and steering?
Very good question, Jarvis. And the way I would look at it is to see that all the things that I've done, I've worked as a professional scientist, I've been a writer, I've advised big companies, I've advised the king. I have led campaigning organizations, and now I work for the British government, leading one of its most important environmental agencies, its National Nature Agency. And I think the way I'd look at it is to see that all of these things are different faces of the same challenge.
I agree. I
Yeah,
agree.
and all of these things are necessary. We do have to have an effective public body that looks after nature. We do have to have campaigners. We do have to have good data. We do have to have good stories and narratives and writers producing all of that. And I guess the thing, that I consider myself just so lucky and fortunate in being able to do is to have a part in all of that. And, I think if there's any value in having a long career, it's in some large part coming from the variety of that career and being able to see the challenge from different perspectives and to understand the different moving parts that are in play. And so I don't look at it as like, a different thing. It's the same thing. And actually, it's quite interesting working now at Natural England. I'm operating in a legal framework that I helped to create when I was campaign director at Friends of the Earth. Another piece of legislation that was a breakthrough in 2000 was the Countryside and Rights of Way Act, which helps to protect some of our most important wildlife. And I now use those laws to do exactly that.
It's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? I mean, it's talk about a full circle.
Exactly. That's right. Yes. Hopefully, not ever decreasing ones, Jarvis.
Let's call it a spiral. Let's call
Yeah,
it a spiral
exactly.
so it
Spiraling
continues.
outwards to bigger things.
Anyway, let's just hold that for a second there, Tony. We're just going to nip to a quick commercial break. We'll be back with you very shortly.
The station that makes you feel good.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. you don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So Tony, we just talked about your new role at Natural England. I say new role, you've been there for 7 years. You're the longest standing director. What happens at the end of this term? Are you going to stay on, or what's the plan?
Well, normally for appointments like this, the chair of a major public body, one would normally serve two terms. One or two terms would be normal. Three terms is exceptional, and I'm now serving a third term, so I'm in already, you know, a place that is not that usual.
Yeah, amazing. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you, Jarvis. No, it's been a very, I've just feel, yeah, incredibly fortunate to have been able to have done this work for so long, and we have made a difference, and it's been good. And but this work will come to an end for me in April 2027. At that point, I will carry on. I don't know what I'll do yet, but I'll be looking during this autumn and early next year for things that I can apply myself to, bringing 45 years of experience in all of this by then.
Amazing.
And hopefully handing on Natural England in good order and good shape to continue doing its work in perpetuity, because, you know, despite the strides we've made with new national nature reserves, species recovery work, policy development on planning and on farming, that work is not done, of course, and it never will be. We are always going to have to work in this dynamic space between the demands of the country and looking after its wonderful ecosystems and wildlife. So there'll be a new chairman to do that work, and also a new chief executive. I've been very lucky to have a wonderful chief exec I've worked with for the last 7 years, Marion Spain. She's stepping down this year as chief executive, having served a very long stint as well. So we'll have a new chief exec and a new chair at Natural England next year. But I do hope that they find that they've got a good organisation being handed to them.
And I think they will. Yeah.
It's confident, it's effective, and it knows what it's doing, and it's got great strategy now as well.
Yeah, I think nature's been very, very, very gifted and lucky to have you, because I know how much you appreciate, you know, nature in its consciousness, in its life force, in its form. You don't just think of it as something separate from us. You very much embody it as part of a whole system that we're a part of. And I love that about you, because that's, you know, it, for me, it's quite a spiritual thing, but I know for you, it just is. It's just the way you are. We worked together, and I was laughing, actually. Back in 2007 or 8, I think it was, I was given the opportunity to run National Geographic Green, which is the world's biggest environmental magazine. I actually took the idea to them. And my editor at the time, she was actually a consulting editor, she put a hot list of people together who could be the editor-in-chief for this magazine. And I remember looking at the list, and this is the first time I was introduced to you. Your name was at the top.
Oh,
and I went back and I researched and we jumped on a call, and you were very, very open and warming and committed to being editor in chief for my first magazine. So I'm very, very grateful for that, Tony. Well, it was amazing.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jarvis. And would you believe, actually, you may recall, I suggested we ran a little column on one of the back pages. Do you remember it? We called it We're Back.
And yes,
that had gone extinct in Britain, but which were coming back. And this is now the title and subject of a book that will come out next April that I've just finished. I just sent it to the publishers. It's called We're Back. Oh. And it is very much inspired by that column that we put into that magazine.
And oh, brilliant.
It's 15 stories of species that went extinct in Britain, but which are now back here. And of course, this is something that not only, you know, was I aware of and interested in back in 2007, 2008, 2009 when we were doing that work. But now, of course, this is a big subject theme for Natural England.
Yes.
To restore missing species. And so, again, it's another one of those full circle moments whereby that idea, which I think was a good idea.
Yeah.
And when I said to the publishers, this book's going to be called We're Back, they said, that's brilliant. We just love it. And so that's what we're, yeah.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Great. I should look forward to it. Let's talk about your books, because your latest book, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet. I guess the argument, as I understand it, is that inequality sits at the heart of
yes.
both the climate and nature crisis. Can you unpack this a bit for us?
Yeah. Oh, there's so much in there, Jarvis. That was the hardest book I have written so far, just because of the subject area. It's so vast and it's so sprawling. And I wanted to avoid polemic and just like being angry, and to write it in a
yeah.
in a measured and rational way with evidence, but also to be readable. And I think I did succeed in the end, but it was hard going. But basically, the simple thesis is that we're not going to be able to solve the nature and climate emergencies without having inequality baked into the analysis, because the problem isn't just an ecological one. It is now very clearly something that is linked with how the world is so divided. So just take, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. A tiny minority of people in the world are responsible for most of it.
Yeah.
The atmosphere. And, you know, the bottom half of humankind is responsible for about 10% of it.
Mm.
And, you know, so that plus the consumption of resources, plastics, metals, wood, all of the things that go into our consumer lifestyles. Again, it's the better off who are particularly, you know, responsible for that level of consumption, and therefore the environmental impacts. We know that inequality drives consumerism. You know, if you're on a lower income, you're more susceptible to these kind of overconsumption type messages, which just kind of reinforces the whole thing. We know that the global picture is made more difficult when, you know, you have an international climate negotiation and, you know, the Europeans and the Americans turn up and say something must be done. Well, the Americans don't say that even anymore. But when, you know, the rich countries turn up and say something must be done, the poor countries say, well, you caused it. You do something about it rather than telling us to
arrest
development. So there's a political problem. And then when you come into like domestic circumstances, like a country like the UK, at every turn, you can see social inequality being used as a reason why we shouldn't act. And so, you know, we've got to keep water prices down because of the impact of people on low incomes. And, you know, that's a very fair and valid point, but it means we haven't invested in the infrastructure over 30 years, which now means our rivers are full of sewage and we don't have enough water storage capacity. We didn't invest because we weren't all in it together.
Mm.
And so on and so forth. And then the rise of populist politics, where environmental action is seized upon as an injustice against the poor to drive a political agenda. And so there's multiple layers to it, but it is real. And so that's why I felt I should write that book. And actually, I draw on a lot of the experiences working with Friends of the Earth International, because I was vice chair for our global network for 8 years, as well as being the director of the national group in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. And so I did see these issues from an African, Latin American and Asian perspective through working with colleagues from those countries. And it always stuck with me, this very profound kind of hidden in plain sight backdrop to these big environmental issues, which is that inequality theme.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. It's such a holistic, you know, it includes everything. And I love the way that, and there aren't that many environmentalists actually that are, certainly if you look at certain from the science perspective, that seem to be having that holistic view. You talk to, you know, indigenous elders. I mean, we did a talk recently where you were on the panel with Domingo Pease, who is out in the Amazon. He's a chief in the Amazon. You know, the first thing that they talk about is this holistic approach about how inclusive it is of everything and everyone. Why do you feel there is such a gap, a separation? What is it in the Western world that we just don't understand?
Well, this is where I had a massive education in being lucky enough to co-author Harmony with King Charles and Ian Skelly.
I was going to come on to that book next, so this is perfect.
So this is, I mean, that is where I had a revelation in the sense of how all this stuff is fundamentally connected together and how it comes down to our worldview. And the question of where that worldview comes from, therefore, is a very, very important one in understanding this crisis that we're now in. And in Harmony, you know, and this is the King's, you know, analysis and thinking. I mean, basically, it comes from the way in which we embarked upon scientific understanding in the West during the 16th century, during the Enlightenment. And, you know, we become better and better at understanding the mechanisms of life and how the universe works.
Yeah.
But as we understand more and more about the specifics, we gradually lose sight of the interconnected nature of everything. And I mean, that's the very short answer. And I think it's true. And, you know, how we connect or reconnect scientific rationalism and all of our incredible technological achievements with that greater understanding about our place in the world,
This
has got to be one of the big priorities in the 21st century. And this is why indigenous wisdom is so important, because that way of looking at the world, it remains. It's alive and well in the Amazon, in the rangelands.
Absolutely.
And that particular perspective is a human perspective that existed for thousands of years, has been largely displaced in the West by scientific rationalism. But that scientific rationalism, which in turn leads to a very fragmented, very kind of disconnected view of the world. We look at every problem one at a time, and we look at it through technologies, and we lose sight of the fact that we're utterly dependent upon a beautiful, functioning natural world to survive. I mean, that's almost nowhere to be seen in our discussions in the West these days. So, that's profound and it's huge. But I think enough people now are beginning to see that this is the heart of the challenge that we face, not the only challenge by any means, but the more we can help people to understand the benefits of seeing the world from that wider perspective, inspired by Indigenous people, then the bigger our chances of getting through what is now looking like an increasingly tricky position for the world.
Yeah, lovely, lovely. I beautifully said. I think this would be a really lovely moment. I always ask my guests to give us a couple of songs that are, you know, soundtracks to their life's work. So tell us the first song you've chosen, Tony, and why.
Well, hard to choose, Jarvis, but I've chosen Machinada by Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66. And this is like a quintessentially Brazilian tune. And not only was this on the radio as I drove with my Brazilian colleagues through the remote parts of northeastern Brazil in an old Series 2 Land Rover, not only was that tune there, but also I went back to Brazil on multiple occasions when I worked on tropical rainforests for Friends of the Earth. And that song always reminds me of being in these beautiful landscapes in the wilds of Brazil.
Lovely. Look forward to hearing it. What a fabulous tune. That's absolutely lovely. It's nice. You get those visuals of being in the Brazilian rainforest. What does it stimulate for you when you hear that song now? Is it nice memories?
Oh, yeah. Lovely memories. Fruit juices, dry, dusty roads, empty vistas with tree-lined horizons in all directions. Yeah, really. And sense of space and beauty and naturalness, but also in a country where people are just pretty happy. And I think that sums it up very well.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said, isn't there, for, you know, what we describe as the divide between the global south and the global north. And you've partly addressed that, you know, with that book Harmony that you did with the King. But what's extraordinary for me, and you will I'm sure agree, is that when you go to these countries that do seem, you know, in relative terms, poorer than perhaps we are, or live differently to we are, more humbly, there just seems to be a lot more happiness in these countries.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting, isn't it, Jarvis? And I, you know, in that remark, you know, we unearth another core problem we've got in the world at the moment in terms of how we judge progress, and this. You know, unassailable commitment that we have to expanding gross domestic product.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not the same as happiness. It's not the same as security. It's not the same as contentment. It's not the same as social cohesion. And it's certainly not the same as sustainability. And so looking at how we are going to judge progress in the future is a really, really big question that sits alongside that world viewpoint and about seeing nature as our ultimate source of health and well-being and security and sustainability. And, you know, happiness is really at the core of that. Can we find ways of measuring happiness and contentment and replacing GDP with something that is more real and which is more human-centric. Another big 21st century job, but a lot of people are beginning to think about that now.
Yeah, agreed. Well, let's just go to our next commercial break, Tony. And what we'll do is when we come back after the break, I want you to give me some clues to what people can do that are listening out there to be very much a part of the solution of your work. So don't go away. We'll be back with Tony with some of those key ingredients for us to live a more wholesome, sustainable life.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, Tony, on this show, we care a great deal about health and well-being. It's UK Health Radio. My job is obviously to talk about the health of the planet. But what's your understanding of the relationship between the health of the natural world and our own, you know, the physical and the mental aspects?
Yeah, so there is now a vast body of data that reveals the very strong connections between human health, both in a physical and psychological sense, and then the access that we have to beautiful natural places with birdsong, walking by water, being able to look at beautiful views, including coasts. We know from a lot of research now that this obviously has benefits, and kind of we all know it, and we kind of all instinctively get it, but we have data, which always helps when we're trying to make a point, especially one that has implications for policy. And so having more access to the natural world is good for people. And of course, also goes without saying, if that natural world is not only beautiful, but also unpolluted with chemicals that do damage to nature and which also do damage to people, then all the better. And so, you know, that connection between the health of nature and the health of people, I mean, it's fundamental. It's very, very clear. Perhaps, however, rather underappreciated in how we plan our world. And
yeah, you know,
intensive agriculture focused on productivity and yields rather than the health of the system that's producing the food. You know, looking at pollution as a price of progress that we, you know, should tolerate and indeed welcome, when in fact some of the damage that's being done is not only a human tragedy but also very expensive for society, as we have to treat the downsides of people suffering from, you know, polluted air and water. So, you know, this is a big one. And that Natural England, you know, this is, it's no accident therefore that our new strategy we've called Recovering Nature for Growth, Health and Security.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, growing happiness and growing a sustainable economy, growing public health and well-being, but also growing security through being able to adapt to climate change and to be able to produce food indefinitely and to have water security through restoring the ecosystems that do all of that. And yeah, it does feel like, you know, we probably couldn't have done that kind of statement of intent 10 years ago. And I think the world has moved on and people are now beginning to see some of these connections in ways they didn't before, which is encouraging. But we're not short of science to tell us this. We know that these connections are real. And if we reflect them in how we behave, we can get some really big benefits for everyone.
Yeah, love that. Love that. Let's talk about those benefits. I think you mentioned the word security. I mean, we've talked about health and well-being. Totally get that. But let's just talk about the security for a minute. So, you know, there was a national emergency for climate and food security recently announced by DEFRA. How bad is the situation, Tony? And also, what can the listeners do in their own lives in order to support a more sustainable and secure food future?
So those security connections alongside the health and well-being and everything else, it's becoming clearer. What can we all do? Probably three big headings, I would say, Jarvis. So one is about the people who represent us in the local council or in parliament, and having a conversation with them as we go along, not only on voting day and before elections, but just remaining in touch with them and letting them know that we all do really want to solve these big environmental problems, because there's always voices there saying, oh, we shouldn't, you know, spend money on recovering nature or reducing emissions. We got more important things to do. It's very important, therefore, for the voices of people who do want to see a more secure and sustainable future being heard. So be in touch with the people who represent you and let them know that you do care and you would like them to act. And then there's a kind of, you know, our role in the market. We all buy stuff. We buy electricity, we buy vehicles, we buy food. And just letting the people who produce all of that, again, know that you don't want deforestation in your food supply, and that you don't want sewage in your river. And if you do want a vehicle, you want one that's not only zero emissions, you want it made by, you know, a circular process that makes sure that when the car's coming to the end of its life, it's going to be reused and all the parts are going to be taken into the next round of manufacturing. And, you know, that constant demand coming from the consumers is really, really important. And then I think there's a piece about culture as well, because, you know, we humans, we are very, very sociable animals, and we're always looking to friends, family, people we might see in social settings for like cues as to how, you know, it's the right way to behave. And I think, you know, showing off consumerist kind of values is something we can all fight against.
So it's
almost as a matter of pride that I wear clothes with holes in and bits missing.
recycled and from recycled, charity shops. Yeah. And
I sometimes see people looking at me thinking, you know, can't he afford a decent shirt? And in fact, actually, that's the point. This shirt is still perfectly good, so I'm still wearing it. And those kinds of little social kind of signals and a little maxim for life. And I'm not the first person to say this. Much cleverer people than me have said this about you just having the discipline to not let anything in your house unless it's beautiful and or useful.
Yeah.
And, you know, that then starts to stop the plastic crap coming through the door. And, you know, you become a more kind of a more conscious consumer as you do that. And as you do that, then the message comes off to people who might visit your house or understand some of the values that are guiding your decisions. And so all of that, think about, you know, people who represent you, think about the market and think about culture. And if you do all of those, then I think, you know, we can all be very, very influential citizens on all of this.
I think that's absolutely brilliant, Tony. Thank you so much. Wise words of wisdom there. I'm conscious that we're at the end of the show and I want to get your next song in. So what we'll do, if there's anything that I haven't asked you that you wanted to answer, please do it quickly. And then you can tell us about your second song and we'll leave that to play out for the end of the show. So anything I might have missed that you wanted to cover?
No, that's good, Jarvis. I think we got some nice lines in there, didn't we?
We did, absolutely. It was brilliant. Yeah. I could talk to you all day. And, you know, sometime in our lives, we'll hopefully get to do that.
One day we will do that.
I know you're never going to retire, but we'll keep fixing stuff together, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, Tony, thank you so much for joining us. You know, 4 decades of defending the natural world and still that sense that a fairer world and a living planet are the same project. It's brilliant. Your book, Just Earth, How a Fairer World Will Save the Planet, is out, so people can find that. You can search for it on stores or in bookshops. And we're going to play your second song. Tell us why you've chosen it and what it's all about, what it does for you.
Yeah, well, one thing, Jarvis, alongside that brilliant team we had at Friends of the Earth back in the early 2000s when we launched the Big Ask campaign, in addition to all those wonderful people I was lucky enough to work with, we did have support from Radiohead, the rock band.
Yes, you did. Tom York was your man, wasn't he? Yeah,
Tom came into the office one day and I showed him some of the latest climate science. He was already very aware of what was going on that. And he said, look, I really want to help. What can I do? And I said, well, would you like to help us with this campaign we're planning called The Big Ask? And he said, yes, he would. And we did a lot of stuff together. We did multiple media appearances. We did appearances at festivals together. And he did a couple of concerts for us to raise some money. And it was just fantastic. Him and Johnny Greenwood and the rest of the band, they were absolutely brilliant and were one of the reasons why that campaign was successful. So I wanted to suggest Subterranean Homesick Alien by Radiohead from their album OK Computer, which is absolutely brilliant. And I think a nice tune to remind us of those great days of when we put public opinion, rock stars, science together to make the case for the Climate Change Act.
Yeah, absolutely. What's happened in our world today, Tony, that we don't have those big artists working together with, you know, we've had Greta and, you know, she created a big storm, but there doesn't seem to be anybody in the music world these days that's prepared to stand up for justice. So what's going on?
I think one of the things is, you know, since we ran that work back in those days, 20 years ago now, the world has changed. And so anyone who does any kind of campaigning and puts their kind of head above the parapet, they get it shot at, as well as, like, you know, being lauded for doing good work. And I think, you know, this has made quite a lot of high profile people pause and hesitate before they get involved with campaigns, which is a shame. Not to say they won't do it and they can't do it. And, you know, I'm sure they will in future. But I think the space in which celebrity operates now in trying to get behind good causes, I think it's changed. And I think it's some of them more nervous.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's time for everybody out there listening to step up and actually be the change that we want to see in the world. Tony, you've been an absolute star. We're going to hear this Radiohead tune. Thank you so much for joining us. Everybody listening, have a brilliant, brilliant rest of the week.
Thank you, Jarvis. Lovely to
see you. Thanks, Tony. We'll be right back.
to see.